And what I've basically found is this: we leverage time differently when we're in true alignment with our purpose, you know, and with our joy. So we all have the same amount of hours in the day as Beyonce, they say, right? But and if we do, the question is then how do you leverage that time? And I find that I can create within 60 seconds far more than I think that I can if I'm doing it with joy and with purpose, right? Not with the annoyance, the frustration that comes in when you're trying to manage too many things coming at you. So that's created, knowing that has created a set of sort of rituals and practices that keep me in a state of flow.
Hey guys, I'm Miles.
And I'm Ruthie.
And welcome to the Unspoken Podcast, where we believe that saying the unsaid may be the hardest, but one of the most important things we can ever do.
Yes, our authentic self is the best gift that we have to offer this world. But sadly, we live in this culture that tells us that we should hide it.
So we would love for you to join us and listen along. And we hope that you might find connection and healing in the courage that no important words go unspoken. Make up fake love, make them all laugh. Someone, take off your mask. It's nice to me.
Today on the podcast, we have Sarah Lewis. Sarah is an assistant professor of history of art and architecture and African American studies at Harvard University. Her scholarship on race, art, and culture has been published in academic journals as well as The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Art Forum. Lewis was the guest editor of the Vision and Justice issue of Aperture, which received the 2017 Affinity Award for Critical Writing and Research from the International Center of Photography, and is the author of The Rise, a book about failure and creativity. Previously, she held curatorial positions at the Museum of Modern Art, New York, and the Tate Modern London.
Wow, Dr. Sarah Lewis, she is a powerhouse. She is one of the brightest minds and one of the most powerful voices, I think, of our generation. Her book was incredible. She influences so many young people and also influences so many influencers. Mm-hmm. And I am lucky enough to call her a friend. And every time I sit with her, I'm blown away by her intellect and her compassion and empathy towards the world and underserved populations and causes. And she is just doing amazing things. And I cannot wait for you to hear from her and learn more about where she came from and what she's up to. Well, here we are, you guys. Excited to be here in the house with Dr. Sarah Lewis.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
So happy to have you. This is such a treat. I'm really looking forward to getting to know you better.
Likewise. Yeah.
We're so honored to, honestly, to be able to catch you for a window because you're really busy. You've got a lot going on, and I know we're going to unpack and hear more about that. But for me, I don't feel like I'm interviewing somebody I admire, although I am. I feel like I'm talking to a friend because we haven't got to connect in the last few years because our seasons have been just moving fast. But we got to meet several years ago through some mutual friends, and I was just drawn to you, I'm sure like a lot of people are, very quickly. I was like, I am fascinated by this woman as a human, but also as just who you are and what you do. There's just layers, a lot of layers. And you got a deep soul, and your intellect clearly speaks for itself. But I'm excited for our audience. I know the world knows you through talks that you've done and books that you've written, which we'll get to, but I'm excited for the world, our world, to get to know you more because I just think you're such an important voice in culture today.
Miles, thank you so much. It means a great deal. I've got such respect for the work you're doing personally and through on-site. So it's really an honor for me.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Well, we usually love starting by just taking us back. You know, where did this all get started?
Oh, how long do we have? Oh, so. Well, you know, Miles, the work you know me through, the writing up The Rise and now the work at Harvard, in part began because I've always been fascinated by and I'm still so curious about just the path of becoming our fullest selves. How do we become the people that we dream of, who we don't even know that we fully can be, you know? grew up here in New York City. And I think because of that, I had at a very young age a sense of the possible around me all the time, and was fascinated by process and arriving at these achievements that would take people to New York. I grew up right by the United Nations, and so I would see everyone coming through literally blocks away. And
wow.
That is something.
Yeah, my playground, literally the swing set was right next to the United Nations.
Wow.
No way.
Yeah. That's my backyard. And so the international news became, for me, the daily kind of bread and butter of what you use to just construct your day and to consider what a life could be like. So that animated my imagination at a really young age. So there I was, you know, in New York, really independent at a very young age too, going to school on my own, fourth grade, fifth grade, and became curious about the life stories of those who inspired me. I didn't think that, I'll leave it at that. And so I would start to just read different narratives, fiction, nonfiction, and I would just find that what I was not taught about the journey of becoming and success, I found that the very kind of foundations of what led to those individuals' so-called rises was not something that we typically discuss, you know? And I became fascinated by how conversions and transformations occur. And oftentimes, as I have written about and now believe firmly, they come from seeing challenges as opportunities and finding the gifts that come from these difficult circumstances. And so it began really in just being both inspired for my own life and for those that I'm hoping will come in the generations that follow, stories that can become guides for creating the lives that we want to and sometimes don't dare to dream that we can live.
You know? You don't even know it's a possibility.
Yeah, exactly.
Until there's something so beautiful about being shown, like there's something so much more and there's so much more out there that, I mean, I love that. I grew up in a teeny tiny town and most people don't leave our town, you know? So I was given the gift from my family of like getting to leave and travel out. And I was like, wait, there's people that don't look like me. And there's people that talk very different from me and have such different lives. And just that kind of exposure is so powerful and so beautiful. It's such a gift to me.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, we call it diversity, but that's not even the right word. The way in which the world sort of descends upon creates New York offered that to me.
Yes.
And as soon as I moved away from it, I realized that that was a gift.
Mm.
So it happened for me later on. So I know what you're describing.
So I'm curious, say more about that, because I know this is something that you're a respected voice on. But when you say diversity is not really the word.
Yes. Well, yes, I do a lot of work now looking at the function of art and culture for expanding our notion of who counts and who belongs in society, in historical context and a contemporary context. So that's a lot of what I write about and teach at Harvard. So when I say the word diversity is not the right word, what I mean by that is the term itself, diversity, somehow suggests that we need to change a current model, that we somehow need to, and that the current model that is not diverse is the norm. You know, and so lately there's been a shift to using words like inclusion, which is sort of similar. But ultimately, I think we all want to have and normalize a set of voices that represent the full extent of life on this planet around us. That's what we want, right? And to have as a default one group as being normally in place and is what we're trying to move away from so that everyone is welcome in various spaces. At Harvard, one of my main classes, just to give you an example, it's probably the least likely place you'd imagine this, but is a room that has no racial majority at all. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
At Harvard, right? Organically, it's not as if we've engineered this.
Right.
So equal parts white, black, Asian American, Latino. And imagine what it means to teach that kind of group. You can't centralize any one experience over the other, right? So it is a daily reminder of the work we need to do for the generations to come, because that's their norm.
I want to get back to that because I got some questions about inclusion, diversity, race.
Yeah.
that one's personal to a conversation we had a few years ago.
Okay.
And, yeah. But take us back to that little girl that played across from the UN and got exposed in such a cool way to just culture and who knows what else. And had this wild imagination of what could be based on this city and this imprint, maybe your family. But where'd you go from there?
Well, where'd I go from there? So I grew up in Midtown Manhattan, really a bustling part of the city, right? It's just commerce and diplomats and everything all at once. And I went to the all-girls school for 13 years on the Upper East Side, the kind of place that, just like Harvard, where I went for college too, made me feel that I could really do anything. Mm-hmm. And that was such a blessing. That was extraordinary. So 5th grade through 12th grade, made friends for life, sisters, all of them, godmother to one of my good friends' daughters, and loved that experience. And that was an experience that did start to teach me about the importance of inclusion too. You know, we can get into that. I went to Harvard and then went to the UK and studied there at Oxford. I'd received a fellowship to go abroad, the Marshall Scholarship/Fellowship. And that funded 3 years of study and gave me a salary so that I could dream and have that supported, right? And I lived there right after 9/11. So it also charged that current moment with, and I think tasked us all with asking what our purpose was. You know, how could we be contributory citizens, really? And I was 22 asking those questions. I also lost a number of friends in short succession within the 2 years of the three that I was there. Mm. And that, of course, both shattered me and then let me put myself back together in a way that let me ask the question, you know, how will you live today in a way that both honors the lives of those who are not here, those who don't have this time, but also makes your whatever I do on the planet of value such that it's a bit more beautiful than when I got here. So that those are the questions I was asking myself at the age of 22 and 23 and 24. And I found that the arts were going to be the arena and the platform that I would kind of play in. But
just real quick on that.
Yeah.
Did, when you referenced you lost some friends, was that in 9/11?
One of them, mm-hmm, the first, actually. So she was a friend that I knew from being here in that K through 12 all-girls school. And she's fantastic. And we played field hockey together. So, you know, that bond you get being 4 years on a team together is like none other. And yeah, she passed in the towers. Mm. And then I had one of my closest friends who I shared a birthday with. And just, it's one of those friends who really sucked the marrow out of every kind of moment of the day, and she left you more energized and excited about life whenever you're in her presence. And she passed, but it feels very much like my guardian angel. After going through the grief process, I don't feel that as a loss. I feel her very much with us even now, and many other friends, but they were all young.
What was her name?
Anna Sue. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. she's just fantastic. So there's a lot I could say about that because it really did put me on, actually, the way you're asking me this question, I hadn't quite thought of it this way before, but a spiritual journey at the very same time that I had defined my own career path. And that gave me a kind of fortitude that it really sustained me and that I draw upon as a reservoir still today, you know? So they're very much intertwined.
You described that you went through that as a shattering and then you rebuilt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was the rebuilding like?
Well, it reminds me of this, quote that's become a kind of koan for me, the Ernest Hemingway quote, you know, all of us are shattered. Some of us remain stronger in the broken places.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
that's effectively what happened to me. You know, I, it's funny. I have a friend. Well, it's not funny. It's actually profound. I have a friend who is a dear friend. She had this injury. It will relate. I promise. She had this injury on her forehead. She had an injury in childhood that put some scar tissue there. And one night after we were having dinner, she got into a cab. I had a premonition that she shouldn't get in this cab, and she did. And the cab had a horrible accident on the road, and she banged her head right in the place where that scar tissue was. And she survived, and the doctor said that if she hadn't had that injury, that scar tissue, she wouldn't have. It was that. And I always... Wow. It feels like an analogy for what that kind of shattering and rebuilding can do. It gives you that kind of fortitude and resilience. But the question is, yeah, do you have an experience like the one you created at OnSite for those who are going through it? Do you have the pastors who will understand that grief perhaps needs a new narrative so that you can rebuild? And I think I was fortunate to trust my kind of, you know, really young instincts about what I needed in that process. Hmm. And so I ended up, and I think loved most writing about this idea of surrender in the book, but I ended up holding on to something that she gave me as a kind of a life lesson, as a way to see the beauty in the grief. She has a pretty dramatic story in terms of, you know, how she lost her life. She ended up really surrendering in the most profound way. She was babysitting her young cousin, 5 years old, who couldn't swim, and she saw he had jumped into a pool and he was drowning, and she couldn't swim herself. But there she is. She's just graduated from Harvard. She's entering into a JD MBA program at Harvard Law. She's engaged to her college sweetheart, and she jumps into this pool to save her cousin, knowing that she can't swim. And she does. She saves him, but she dies. And just, I mean, I get full talking about it because it's the clarity of that knowing in that moment that we are all connected, right? And so it doesn't even matter what she's about to do if his life is as important as hers. And it's as if she knows that. And so the idea of surrender in the most profound way became something that her life really challenged me to consider about how I might lead my own. And it's a gift that's just irreplaceable. So
that is, yeah, I've got chills. And I do watch you do that over and over, even from afar when we don't communicate. In a sense, she stepped into her divine calling at that time, conscious or unconscious, boom, you know, went for it. And I see, and it's a risk, and I see you stepping into your divinity over and over again and taking risk and disrupting different spaces and speaking into them in a cool way. And anyway, I'm just...
Thank you. No, it was, I think, one of the highlights.
That's such a beautiful thing when we are so deeply impacted by someone's life and you know, and they're no longer here. Like, I have a really dear friend who was so impactful to me in college. And I remember when we were in college, people were like, y'all are so much alike. And I was like, no, like, her kindness and her beauty and what she came forward with was not to get anything back. She just wanted to, she knew how loved she was, and she wanted to just love people. And at that time in my life, I needed people's approval to feel okay. And she ended up passing from a drunk driver. And I was in a really bad car accident, but like on paper, my injuries were way worse than hers. And then here she doesn't survive, and I did. And I remember years ago, I had like a complete nervous breakdown, and I would just sit there and I would think, like, Laura should be here. Like, she would be out changing the world. And I'm here like wasting my, I had lived in my bed for like 7 years from chronic pain and handled it. I mean, I have so much grace for that girl now, but I had handled it very poorly for a very long time. And it's been so interesting and so beautiful to change that narrative. Like, Laura was a gift, a profound gift to me and everyone that was lucky enough to come into her presence. And for some reason that I might not understand, the side of heaven or whatever's up there or out there or whatever, I am still here, but I carry her with me. And I like to think, like, if anyone feels even like pieces of being seen and being loved, she taught me. I watch her. I carry that, and she's within me, and they're getting pieces of Laura. And if you experience, like, you know, if someone feels like held and just cared for, I'm like, Laura taught me that. You're getting pieces of Laura. And it's such a, I don't know, I changed that story. For some reason, I'm here and Laura's not. But her spirit feels like what you were saying before, you carry them with you. And like her goodness lives, I feel her goodness. And I want to honor her life with what I've been given, you know? And so I just love how you said that and how you describe that, because I get that so much. And like when we lose someone that's so young, she was 19, you know, and that's her prime. And I'm like, she would have done so much good in this world. But I can't question it. She, you know, I'm here and I want to honor that. And I want to hopefully make people feel loved like Laura did, you know? And so it's interesting when those things, those formative years, those things happen and you're just like, what in the world? But what do you do with that?
Exactly. Well, you are making people feel loved. I can feel it. It's beautiful.
Thank you. You too.
I had no idea we would talk about this today. It's really sort of amazing that we are. I should share one other anecdote with you about this idea of being wanting to know that you're not alone on the path. Mm-hmm. Is so important. It's also what I think makes a kind of gathering like this, even just us speaking together, but with those who are listening too, an act that's about more than a podcast or anything. You know, it's about how it is that we nourish one another.
Yeah.
I had this experience though that got me to understand that when I was brought low by grief with Anna's passing and the compound effects of everyone's passing, my friends. And I remember being here in New York, and this will give you a sense of just how low I was. I really was kind of arguing with God, really. And I was shopping for groceries and about to go to my then boyfriend's house, and it's maybe a 30-block distance, so I was taking a taxi. And I remember this was how low I was sort of made by grief. I sort of said to God, okay, I need a sign to know that you're with me, that Anna's still with me. I'm going to, because I don't have enough money in my pocket for a cab for this distance. This is so complicated. I'm going to know it's you if you help me here. I want you to give me a sign that lets me know when it's the right time to hail the cab so that I'll have the exact amount of money I need to get home. This is so complicated. I'm sure you can't do this, you know. So I start walking, and almost as immediately, upon saying that, I get this clear sign. You know when you receive something and it's not you creating it? It was that kind of a sign. And so I turned around and I hailed the cab, and I noticed that the taxi driver didn't turn on the meter. And I thought, oh, God, that's not a big enough sign. That happens all the time in New York. And then I said to the driver, you know, you didn't turn on your meter. I thought I should let you know. And he turns around and he said to me, I'll never forget the look on his face. He said, you know, this would frustrate a lot of people, but when you have God in your life, none of this matters.
What?
And he showed me this prayer book that he used to meditate upon at stoplights. This is a New York City cab driver. And he said, so, you know, why don't you just pay me whatever you have and that'll be fine.
Wow.
I had no word. I mean, so there are things we can't explain.
Yeah.
That's statistically impossible to have created, but not possible through the realms that we know really kind of govern, or at least I believe govern so much of what we do and everything that we do, really. So companionship on the path, yes.
There's times where I am in the depths and I need my friends to be mirrors of truth to me and
That's
to
right.
be reminders.
Yes.
And then there's times when they're there and I'm like, oh, but here's what I know to be true about you and about me and about the world, you know, and we get to live side by side and be that for each other. Like, I needed to hear that reminder that you just gave us. And that is such a beautiful gift that you've given us, you know, and that's so often we see these things and we're like, oh, that girl is, she has such a light. But I'm like, why would I not say that? Who is ever bummed by a compliment? Like, get out of here. You know, like if you see something that's beautiful, like again, like what I was just saying, like when that becomes a focus, when I'm looking for that in people and in things and places, I find it everywhere.
Absolutely.
Everywhere. Mm-hmm. In the most minute, smallest things, I'll be like, it'll take my breath away, you know? And if I go in with the other mindset, I also can find all the broken things. But there's something so sweet about like really looking for the goodness in humans and believing that there's goodness there. And so often I can just put someone in a, you know, in a box and be like, this is who they are. And then what a disservice to the human spirit and being. And I'm so different than I used to be. And I'm so grateful that people didn't give up on me.
I think it's so well said, but I think it's so important that we stop and speak truth into the unspoken parts of our story along the way and take time for stuff like this. Like, you know, we got like 5 minutes into your story, which is beautiful. I was sitting there thinking, man, how can this highlight reel get bigger? And we were just in the UK at that point, and this rising art star. And I want to pick that back up and see where you went from there, because I love what you're doing now. But to stop at a moment and honor the parts that weren't highlight reel, that were which is a lot about what you wrote about in The Rise, about other people's stories. But to know somebody who a lot of, I'm sure, young women, just people in general, look up to hear that you've been there too in your own way, that you've overcome adversity. And it's just, thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for letting us see Anna and learning about her. I'm so grateful that we got to learn about her and meet her today.
Same here. You know, it's the reason that I wrote that book was precisely for this reason. If we just share the kind of polished, finished veneer of what we think achievement looks like or success, we rob ourselves of those guideposts we need.
Yeah.
Understanding of process that we need to help one another and ourselves. Mm. So this is what the book is about. This is also just the way that I must live now. So yeah. Mm. Yeah, we can do highlight reel too. That's fun. You know, there's a lot more highlights.
We'll make that a small part of it, but that's something should be affirmed and celebrated too. So yeah. Rising star in the art world, comes out of the UK. And what happened next?
What happened next? That, let's see. So I was living in the UK and it became like a paradise, really, you know? And I didn't fully want to leave, but a guy brought me back in part, but really it was the job that brought me back at the Museum of Modern Art. I wanted to curate here. I wanted to be close to family and be home. So I got this job. It was sort of one in a couple thousand sort of odds of getting at the Museum of Modern Art, and applied cold, sent my resume in to like info@MoMA.com.
Did you really?
I really,
you didn't like know anybody, and like that's amazing. I did not know
incredible.
That.
Incredible.
And I need to put this out there publicly because people always think I somehow knew a patron or someone. People confuse me for being the daughter of a patron in the art world a lot with the same last name. That's not me. That's not me. I just said, no, I didn't know anyone at MoMA. I was, you know, a kid. I just graduated from school. I did, though, take a class with a former curator at MoMA. His name is Robert Storr. Talk about the way the universe works. As it turns out, the job that I was applying for, unbeknownst to me, was working for him.
Wow.
Yeah. He had come back. He had to curate the show he had put into motion before he left on this legendary painter, Elizabeth Murray. And so he hadn't selected, actually, the application. It just so happened that it worked out that way.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what brought me back, this dream job at MoMA. So
what happened with the guy?
Oh, he's somewhere.
He's alive.
He's somewhere.
I've got a few of those too. Like, yeah. They're somewhere. They took me here, but
part of the journey.
Yeah, part of the journey. Yeah. No. So MoMA was a good 3-year process of discovery and learning. I was the baby curator, effectively, in the ranks of things, and loved it. I grew up down the street from MoMA. About 5 blocks from MoMA.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, heart of
gracious.
New York. So it was a homecoming in a nice way.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this may be a dumb question, but especially for somebody as esteemed as you are in the art world, but what all would a curator do at that level?
Mm-hmm. You know, the curatorial process is pretty mysterious to people. Okay, so the Latin of the term comes from the root, you know, curare, to care for. You're caring for this incredible collection, effectively, is what you're doing. So that involves determining which portions are going to come on display for the general public. Whenever you go to a museum, you're seeing, on average, 10% to 1% of the entire collection of that museum. So who determines what narratives are brought forward through the selections you make from the larger whole? That's the curator's job. The next, you know, is about acquisitions, determining what will also come into the collection in the future, and then also being the public face for the institution and making sure that people understand the history of the art on display. There's a ton of admin too. There are a ton of things that aren't glamorous that you have to do. That falls to the baby curator typically. Registrars, other things. But it's an extraordinary place to learn. I mean, the Museum of Modern Art has the renowned collection. So when you are 24, as I was, and have that as your training ground,
wow,
it gives you a great springboard to really go anywhere, do anything.
So what made you, you know, you're at the top of the game in that world, and that must have been such a cool experience to be at that level. But then it seems like you've continued to evolve all your skill set into how to help through your writing and through art, how to help evolve culture and people become the best versions of themselves. And what do you think is in you that drives you to do that with all of your skill set?
I mean, the inspiration, Anna, is certainly one. The inspiration, though, for all of my work to think through how it is that we can become our fullest selves comes from my grandfather, who is an artist, and who would have been thrilled that I was at MoMA, who passed when I was in college. He grew up also in New York City, in Brooklyn, ultimately lived in Philadelphia. I love Philly too. But he made me want to consider this idea because of his life story. I mean, the short version of the longer is that he became an artist and a jazz musician for unusual reasons that confused me for a while. He had this experience in high school here in 1926 in history class in the 11th grade when he was asking just a simple question. He wanted to know why the history textbooks didn't represent the world the way that he saw it in New York City. Mm-hmm. You know, it's deep segregation at that time in America, so you can imagine what the textbooks are like. So he's asking this question of the teacher, and the answer he received about why the history textbooks didn't represent the world the way that he saw it here in New York City was that the rest of the world that wasn't there simply hadn't done enough to merit inclusion in those textbooks. And he kept asking that question, and he refused to accept the answer that he was given. And so he was expelled for his impertinence, so-called impertinence, right? 1926. And he never went back to high school. He never got a college degree, GED college degree. But he became this extraordinary artist, putting into those genre scenes that he would create the very images he wanted to find in those textbooks and knew that he could find in those textbooks. He went on to play backup with Count Basie and Duke Ellington as a jazz musician. But it surprised me that he wouldn't have become a politician or an activist, I mean, after that kind of an experience. Why turn to the arts? But it occurred to me that, of course, the arts have so much to say about how it is that we construct a society in which we all know that we count. Mm. Yeah, and how these unusual circumstances, the kind that he had, difficult circumstances, actually help us flourish into who we're supposed to become, you know. With that orientation, my grandfather, Shadrach Emanuel Lee, is his name. I'm named, my initials at least, after him, Sarah Elizabeth Lewis. He is a North Star very much.
Yeah.
So, and let me not just look at the arts as a kind of arena that I could have fun in, but as a place with real weight,
yes.
You know, that could let us understand how it is that we're supposed to become and think about our lives creatively in a holistic sense. So it made me hungry for different kinds of opportunities. So curating became one of many things I wanted to do. You know?
Yes.
So that's led to writing, led to speaking, led to teaching now, and who knows what next.
So. And it's so beautiful to see how his curiosity also passed down, you know, asking questions of like, why is it this way? Like, who said this is the way? I mean, it feels like that's such a huge part of what you're doing. You're asking a lot of sometimes hard questions and really digging in. Like, that curiosity has come down the line in such a beautiful way.
It's interesting. I had never thought of that as the sort of spiritual inheritance of being his granddaughter. That's right. It is the questions. I mean, research is a journey of asking these questions constantly. This Nobel Prize-winning physicist that I interviewed, Andre Geim, won the Nobel Prize in 2010, and he says about research, sometimes I say I don't research, I only search, you know.
I love that. Yes.
This is what it's about. And
yes.
When you're curating, when you're doing work that's about presenting an answer, you can't always ask the questions. You can't always let that be the driving force behind what you do. So I needed other things. I still love curating, though. I still do it. But yeah.
Now you're teaching at Harvard.
Yeah.
Not many people can say that.
Casual.
A Harvard professor.
Yeah.
What lights you up most about that role?
I couldn't possibly just say one thing, but there's so many. But I think it's both that I wake up every day feeling the privilege of being on this Olympic squad of minds that are all deeply committed and on the leading edge of their field, advancing knowledge, truth in it, but also taking the time to inspire their colleagues to do the same. It's an extraordinary culture.
Wow.
In that context, you know. There's a deep sense of just of integrity with the work and lack of envy too, such that you really can fly amongst one another. That's one reason. But the other, as an educator, as a teacher, is that I love feeling as if I can be contributory every day, that I can offer what I hope will enhance both lives and the collective work that we're all trying to do on this planet in the little way that I can. So it's one of the few kind of platforms that lets you do that on a consistent basis. And I love that. Yeah. I never thought I would be at Harvard as a professor. It was never in my mind's eye as a dream. Even when I was getting the PhD at Yale, after MoMA, I got the PhD at Yale, and it came to me, this job.
Wow. You know,
I thought I'd go back to the art world as a curator, but this job was created, basically, for me. It was,
wow.
I had a fellowship when I was writing my dissertation. I had a fellowship at Harvard as I was writing my dissertation and was about to go onto the market interviewing for jobs elsewhere, and gave a talk, as we all had to do as fellows, and it led to my giving a job talk, as they call it.
Wow.
And got the job, yeah, that they
kismet.
Had created. Yeah, kismet,
yeah.
Total kismet. So now I work alongside the professors who taught me as a student.
That's incredible.
It is pretty incredible.
Wow, such a full circle. Yeah. Beautiful. And to go from, you're asking these really hard questions and you're bringing things to the forefront that are like, we need to see and we need to hear. And it's a really beautiful thing. And I'm just like, I'm very proud of you and very honored that I get to like learn from you and that your students get to learn from you in this world. Like, I know you have so much to teach us. And it's incredible.
Thank you. You know, that is the true answer. I'm teaching at Harvard the very material that my grandfather was expelled for asking about and believing was valid. Yeah. What everyone should understand, that we all count, that we all belong.
Yes.
So that's the most sort of electric experience. The culture at Harvard is one thing, but it's the opportunity that I have that's been generations in the making.
Yeah.
That's the most profound.
And also speaking to, like, we have come a long way, but obviously there's still massive gaping problems in that world.
Oh, yeah.
Huge. And it's I think some people are like, oh, that was just back then. That's not, are you kidding me? Like,
oh,
it's so prevalent. It is so, and so that's why I just, like, your voice is so important. It matters. It's so, like, we need to be reminded, and this needs to come to the forefront of, like, this is what's happening, and this is very real today, you know?
Yeah. I think I should say, I mean, really, just to be frank, I also love being a young Black woman who's a professor at Harvard, too, frankly.
Yes.
It does a lot of the work of representational justice that I teach about. The fact that even in coming here to see you today, that I am quite positive that there's not one person who assumed that that was my job, that I'm a Harvard professor, you know, speaks to the work we need to do in terms of realigning this nexus of power, ultimately, and identity, really.
Yes.
I'll give you an example, though. I was on a panel with three colleagues at Harvard, and I invited my students. It was a large conference, and the panel, it just so happens, was comprised of four Black women. We were all Black women, all professors at Ivy League schools, all with PhDs from Yale, actually, from the same advisor. And one of my students at the end of the panel asked me a question I couldn't believe was a true one. She said, I couldn't hear the bios. Are you all professors? She's a Black woman who's a student at Harvard, you know. That's her conditioning, right? Wow. So it's also just an embodied model, I think, that I offer too, that's not lost on me. Sometimes I forget that because I have, there are lots of other, you know, Black women who are professors at Harvard, Black men. I have extraordinary colleagues. But it's work and the visuality of my doing this work in the public realm, the minds that I hope to shift about what's possible is part of what inspires the journey too.
I echo what Ruthie said about the importance of your voice. I got to experience it. I referenced it earlier, but when you came down to see what I was doing as a young entrepreneur, I was excited and scared to death, you know, about some where we were and how we were evolving. And I meet a lot of interesting, fun people, and some become friends and some just become acquaintances, but not many. And often they'll say, "What you do sounds so cool." And I'll say, "Yeah, you should come see it sometime." And maybe 3% will follow up and be like, "Yeah, I actually want to." And you did. You know, you followed up, you came, you know, we had this best time showing you around. And you spoke this beautiful truth about seeing me in what I was doing and how I was showing up, and you felt like it was important in the world. And in the middle of that, you spoke another firm truth, but in a gentle way, about what I needed to improve on, which is the area we're talking about. It's like we're trying to do something that's important in the world, and it feels there weren't people of color there in the way that there needed to be. But I'll never forget, it planted a seed in me that is still evolving today, so much so that progress is happening, not at the pace that I'd like it to. But I've never really told you that, but I really credit you having the courage to step into that conversation with me in a way that I really heard it and I got it. To how I've evolved as a human, but also as a leader with my organization. And it's still very important all the way to up. We may have had one of the most important conversations about diversity last week in one way that I feel like, okay, not only are we making progress, but we're going to make progress. So sometimes you never know what a word, what an affirmation, what curiosity, what coming down to see And thank you for that. I know you probably do that for hundreds of people, but you did it for me, and I'm grateful.
Oh, Miles, I had no idea. It was such a privilege to come and to see the extraordinary work you're doing at OnSite, and I know the day is coming when I'm going to get to write the chapter about you and the work. But it was so memorable. But that moment you're describing, I remember so vividly. I remember where we were even. And thinking through, too, about whether I should say what I felt in my heart was just needing to be said at that moment. But I said it because you have this extraordinary capacity to see people not just as they are, but as they could be. Mm. That's your work, or as they are becoming, you know. Mm. And I knew that because of how you also received me as we first met, you know. So I felt comfortable making that statement. But I also, I think in hindsight, probably did it because I know you're a leader, you know. Mm. So I knew it was going to impact, hopefully, not just OnSite, but your entire industry, so to speak, or the entire field that you're working in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I did want to ask, we work with a lot of influential people who are making an impact in the world, and it can be a taxing experience. I mean, it comes with sacrifice. It comes with travel and time and a lot of hours, as you know. And it seems like the better you get at it, the more opportunities you get. And I've worked with so many, and I've experienced it a little bit myself, where you get to certain places where you thought you'd never get, and it doesn't feel as rewarding as I thought it'd be when I got there. And at some of my successful times have been my loneliest times. And I just am curious about how you balance that work-life piece.
Oh gosh, yeah. How long do you have? That's so important, that question. It's so rich. Yeah, I also find that to be the case. The very goal that drives the journey isn't actually as sweet as the process of arriving itself. You know, it's the reach it's that matters. It's why I was so fascinated by the idea of mastery as opposed to success in writing about the rise, because success is just achievement. Mm. It's what the world confers upon you. It's not necessarily even how you see yourself, but mastery is that constant pursuit, and it means caring about that reach and that near win. The first time you sense that or get a taste of that, it's confusing, you know, because we're somehow taught that the process isn't what counts as much as whatever gold medal equivalent is what you'll receive in your field. That somehow, I think I learned that young because of the compound grief. It just realigned meaning and life for me in a very profound way. You know, so because as I mentioned with Anna, you know, she had all the accolades almost in the world at that age of 23. I mean, she was about to have 3 Harvard degrees at the age of 20, and it didn't matter. Like, none of it mattered. What mattered was how she lived and who she was in companionship with and how she had inspired others. So it reminded me that the journey was what really would count in the end. The work that I'm doing now, though, it feels very much like it's sort of forcing me to live on a mountain in a way, you know, like constantly finding something to propel the reach. And it can feel a little bit like rare air, you know, because it's actually harder to push yourself once you've achieved a certain level of success to do the work that you know is still in you. And it's also harder because you do receive more opportunities that take you away from the very deep dive that you need to create more work.
That's right.
So it becomes this almost like body cloning question. How do I create more hands, time, hours, you know, to get it done? How do I do all this to also find the support that I need, right, from friends? And what I've basically found is this: we leverage time differently when we're in true alignment with our purpose and with our joy. So all the same amount of hours in the day as Beyonce, they say, right? But and if we do, the question is then how do you leverage that time? And I find that I can create within 60 seconds far more than I think that I can if I'm doing it with joy and with purpose, right? Mm. Not with the annoyance, the frustration that comes in when you're trying to manage too many things coming at you. So that's created, knowing that has created a set of sort of rituals and practices that keep me in a state of flow so that I can keep working at with a lot of momentum. Those rituals are meditation at the start of the day, other things to keep the house I'm in, the body I'm in, and shape, all that kind of thing is crucial for the day. But the balance is always a work in progress. But those are some of the ways that I try to keep it together.
Awesome. Thanks. Well said.
I don't know if any of that made sense.
No, it did. Yeah. It's a lot of good stuff in there.
It's so loaded. And it's a constant ever. I mean, like, it's an everyday working at thing.
Yeah.
Because like you're getting to do all these things that you love and you feel so honored, but then you're like, and I'm exhausted and I don't have time for, so like finding that sweet balance, it's a constant striving to, know, to stay centered and grounded and take care of yourself in the midst of the crazy. That's, it's just, it's so important.
Absolutely.
For anything to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we love to do at the end is kind of going back to like little girl you, can you think of something that you wish that you could have heard or said to that little girl that you needed to hear but didn't necessarily hear it? Is there like a word or a sentiment that you'd want to give her?
Oh, I love that. I think what I'd want to remind my little girl self is to continue to follow the light, basically. Mm. And I say that because my first word actually was light.
Wow. Wow.
I still can't believe that was my first word, but it was. My mother tells a story of me literally pointing to this light in the house in Pennsylvania where they had a country place. And my mom turned around, she said, "What did you say?" I said the word again, and I pointed to the light to make sure she knew. I knew what I was talking about. Not mom or dad, but light. And it's it just feels like I knew then what we get trained to forget, that that is all you're here to do, right? Mm. To find that, to be that, to remain inspired by that. Mm. And to forget everything else that doesn't allow for that, basically, simply put.
So as we close out here, are there any new projects that you want to talk about?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to continue to write. I have a lot of books coming out in 2019, and I'll continue to teach at Harvard. The work I'm doing now really focuses squarely on the question of how the arts and culture in general have enlarged our notion of who counts and who belongs in society. Writing on that is the work, continuing to speak about that. Some fun media projects coming out about that. I'm thrilled.
Well, I know I got an inside track because we're friends, and I heard a little bit, and I know I can't say because you probably are under NDAs and stuff, but just pay attention to Dr. Sarah Lewis. You can find her on socials and on her website, but there is some really cool stuff coming out, as you said, media-wise, book-wise, speaking-wise, and just, continuing to teach from your heart. I just want to say as we close, and I wish we didn't have to because I could keep talking to you all day, but I said in the beginning, I think your voice is really important. What I like about today is that sometimes people get known and branded based on their extreme gifting. In your case, it might be intellect or, that's admirable. And yet there is more to you than what you know. There is this whole person that is heart, soul, and just really integrated and connected. And I've known that since we had the opportunity to sit together the first time. It continues to get validated even all the way up to, it feels like no time passed and here we sit again. I'm so thankful you took time with our audience to share a little bit about who you are and what you're doing in this world. It's so important and so awesome, as are you.
Yes. Thanks. I feel so like much. We barely scratched the surface. I'm so honored that we got to share this time with you today, and I'm so excited to get to meet you and to know you and to follow along in your journey and just be cheerleading you all along the way. And I'm excited to learn from you and just see the beautiful light that you are in the world. So thank you so much. This was such a gift.
Likewise, thank you both. Really, really an honor. You both are incredible. Thank you.
Make up fake love, make them all laugh. Come on, someone, take off your mask. It's nice to me.
Thank you guys so much for being here with us today. We know that your time is valuable, so it just means the world to us that you would spend your time and energy with us. The music from our podcast is from one of my favorite bands, Oliver Riot, and the song is called Alcatraz, and it is from their EP Hallucinate, and I just cannot speak highly enough about these boys. They have a new record coming out soon, and you should check them out. They're amazing.
Definitely go get their music wherever you can get it. They are amazing, and you're going to love them as much as we do. If you want to learn more about The Unspoken Podcast, please go to theunspokenpodcast.com for show notes and information about the guest. And please follow us on Instagram at The Unspoken Podcast. We'd also love for you to subscribe to the podcast and help us spread the news and share this, because we cannot wait to show you what's up next. And we will be with you all again soon.